of several books, the latest, New York's Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit. Matthew is also the local host of Morning Edition here at Kansas Public Radio. Matthew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you for inviting me.
Before we talk about the specifics of this incredible engineering feat, take us back to the 1860s. How did people get around in big cities like New York City?
So New York City and really all the cities on the East Coast and to a lesser extent Chicago were very crowded. And waves of immigrants were coming to the United States, really beginning in the 1840s, but through the 1850s, 60s, and then even more so after the Civil War, immigration really increased. So the cities were very densely packed, but there were very few options for getting around. Everyone depended on the horse. You either rode a horse or you rode a vehicle that was pulled by a horse. Public transportation options, especially for the poor or working class, were very limited. In New York, for example, there were really only two options. One was called the omnibus, which was really just a big stagecoach that the drivers would pack with as many people as possible. Then in the 1840s, 1850s, we begin to see streetcars, horse-drawn streetcars. So these vehicles ride on rails, so they're much smoother, a little more efficient, a little faster, but still you're depending on horses, and you're really at the mercy of all the other traffic, especially when you're on rails, you can't drive around anything. So you have to imagine New York in the 1860s and 1870s, especially lower Manhattan. At that time, most of the population was concentrated very low on the island of Manhattan. The streets are teeming with horses, with vendors, with these omnibuses and streetcars, private vehicles, delivery wagons, people just riding horses for transportation. There are no traffic safety rules. Of course, there's no stoplights. There's not even stop signs. We're still not fully decided on which side of the road we're going to drive on. And just crossing a street like Broadway in Lower Manhattan was a very dangerous activity. Police would escort women across the street because it would be impossible. There would be no break in traffic for you to be able to walk across the street. So it was absolutely a terrible jam, a terrible mess. And it really became an issue, especially after the Civil War, when the economy starts to take off again, populations go up again, industry increases, that people were not able to move within the cities. With any ease. And so that's why coming up with a public transportation solution was a priority, not just in New York, but really everywhere.
Enter Alfred Beach.
Yeah. So Alfred's born in 1826. His dad owned the New York Sun, so he grew up in some wealth. When he was 20 years old, Alfred bought a magazine called Scientific American, which is still with us today. It had just been founded a year before. And Alfred was also an inventor. He made his own inventions. He invented an early version of a typewriter. He invented the centrifugal bowling alley. Right. So he loved bowling. Alfred Beach loved bowling for some reason, thought it was the most healthy activity you could engage in. And so he built a mini bowling alley. It had two loop-de-loops.
Like that you could have in your own home.
Right. So if you had an apartment, which I'm sure the neighbors would love, you put in a little bowling alley where you roll the ball, it goes through the two loops and then knocks the pins over. So he was an inventor. As the owner of Scientific American, he really encouraged American invention and innovation. This is a time there's not even a lot of engineering schools at the time. Inventors didn't have a resource to ask questions, you know, get their questions answered, find out information on the latest inventions. And so Alfred made Scientific American that resource for American inventors. And he was a commuter. He lived in Brooklyn, but he worked in downtown. And then later he bought a house near downtown, but it would still take him about an hour to navigate the traffic to get to work. So he was looking for a solution to this problem. And he came up with the idea of an underground railroad. Now, this is even before the first subway was built in London in 1863. Alfred was already thinking about an underground railroad. The problem with the subway in London, the London Underground, was that the carriages were pulled by steam engines, and of course in the tunnel this meant there was a lot of smoke and cinders. It was very uncomfortable, even unhealthy. So Alfred began thinking, well, there has to be a better way to do a subway, and that's kind of the road he went down.
The original plan that Alfred Beach proposed was quite modest. It was ambitious in its own way, but the plan as approved was very different from what he ended up doing.
Right. So the problem was Alfred could never get permission to build this thing. He wanted to build a subway. He wanted to build a short demonstration line, a proof of concept. But Boss Tweed, the famous political boss, the head of Tammany Hall at the time, well, he was on the board of one of the streetcar companies, and the omnibus operators and the horse-drawn streetcar operators all paid tribute to Boss Tweed, and so he naturally defended their interests. He would never allow a competitor to come in and challenge the omnibuses and the streetcars for supremacy in public transportation. So Alfred Beach knew he could never get permission to build a subway, but he knew he could get permission for a smaller project. And so he proposed building a pneumatic tube that would connect the post office with one of the major hotels, actually. I believe it was the Astor. And so he got permission to build this pneumatic tube to carry mail. And so he began constructing this thing. But what he was really doing was using it as a cover to build his subway. He said, oh, well, we're going to build two tubes next to each other. Let's build one large tube to hold the two tubes. Why, that's 8 feet across. I believe we could fit a passenger carriage in that. So that's how he was able to build this, basically in secret. People knew he was building something, but he had a cover story. He was building small pneumatic tubes to carry mail, but what he was really doing was building this subway.
Not only was he doing this in secret, but the subway that he was proposing was really revolutionary in terms of its engineering. What was so special about Beach's plan?
It was a pneumatic tube subway. Pneumatics, it was the age of pneumatics. Pneumatic power was the future. And I mentioned before the steam engines that pulled the subways in London, of course, they generated lots of smoke and cinders. The horse-drawn streetcars and the omnibuses were pulled by horses, which generated their own thing, lots and lots of it deposited directly on the street every day. Pneumatics offered a clean, comfortable ride. 20 feet underground, it was always the same temperature. It was cool in the summer and warm in the winter. And so Alfred Beach designed and patented a pneumatic tube subway. And he built this line. It was about 300 feet long. Again, he's just trying to prove the concept. Buys a giant fan, a blower, they called it. Apparently there's a difference between a blower and a fan. I'm still not quite sure what it is. But it was a giant fan built in Indiana by the Roots Company. And they put it down underground, and this fan would blow, and it would push this passenger car that was exactly the same shape as the tunnel, the round tunnel. It would blow it down the tunnel, and then they would reverse the fan, and it would suck the car back up to the station. And he built a grand waiting room for everyone with chandeliers and goldfish in the fountains and settees and a ladies' room and paintings on the wall. He wanted to make this as appealing to the public as he possibly could, because the plan was, once he made it public, the public acclaim, the clamor for this thing to be built the length of Manhattan would be so great that he could overcome any political opposition there was to it.
Matthew Algio is the author of New York's Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit. If his voice and name sound familiar, he's also the local host of Morning Edition here at Kansas Public Radio. As you said, Alfred Beach faced a number of hurdles in his quest to bring underground mass transit to New York City, and I want to hit them kind of one at a time. First of all, the physical obstacles. This was such a huge engineering feat. Can you describe the tunneling shield that he used to just move all that dirt out of the way?
He invented a machine to dig the tunnel. It was called a tunneling shield because as it moved forward, there was a large metal roof on it that would protect the people who were doing the excavating from any collapse in the tunnel, and then they would brick the tunnel as they went along. Nobody, of course, had ever built a tunnel that long under New York. People didn't know, would the building survive? This was one of the major oppositions that the landowners had. Our buildings are going to collapse. They were afraid the street would collapse. And so, really, Beach proved the concept of a subway in New York, that it was feasible, that you could do it on a practical level. So it was an amazing feat of engineering. I think it was only about 80 days or so it took them to excavate this 300 feet underneath Broadway using laborers, Irish laborers that he hired, that were sworn to secrecy, basically. They couldn't tell people what they were really working on. Again, the cover story is we're just doing a little pneumatic tube to move mail. They're actually building a grand waiting room and this 300-foot-long tunnel. And as I said, Beach himself invented the machine to dig the tunnel, and it's really the basis even today of these ginormous boring machines that they have that build these tunnels. It kind of builds on the concepts that Beach came up with. So it was really an amazing feat of engineering and technological achievement.
How did he keep this all secret? I mean, all those people working for him, how did word not get out that this is not what it appears?
One thing I would like to know is exactly how much he paid the workers, because at the time, $1, $1.50, $2 a day would be a good salary for a working man doing a you know, laboring. So I wonder if he didn't pay them a little extra to have them keep the secret. He also, though, was very smart. He had the charter for his pneumatic tube company written in such a way that it was not subject to public inspection by the city inspectors. Very cleverly, he was an expert, really, and his brother had served in the state legislature. He knew how to write a bill. And so when they wrote this charter for the pneumatic tube, again, the premise being it's just going to be for mail, they wrote it in such a way that it was only subject to the jurisdiction of the Croton Aqueduct Company, which was the water company in New York, and Alfred knew those people well. So there was no outside interference, and so he kind of protected it from public scrutiny that way. Of course, people knew something was going on. I mean, they were removing dirt from the building, and they saw large pieces of machinery being taken down there. But again, it was a great cover story that he had.
You mentioned the Irish workers, largely Irish Catholic workers that were working on this tunnel. Tell us about the role that St. Barbara played in this.
It's an interesting story because belief and, in a way, superstition come into it in a lot of different ways. So St. Barbara was the patron saint of tunnelers. I guess she began as the patron saint of miners and then expanded her mandate to include anyone who worked underground. And so it was a custom that you would always keep a small statue of the saint on site. And this is something that's adhered to this day. People working underground generally keep some memento, especially if they're Catholic, of St. Barbara on site. I also want to mention, kind of along those lines, that you had this psychological barrier that people had to going underground. This was one of the things that Beach had to overcome as well. There was this belief that people would not want to go underground. Underground was the place of the dead. It was where hell was. Why would you want to build a subway to hell? So there was a psychological, and people were used to riding, of course, in trains across countryside, even in the city. You could look out the windows, but suddenly you were riding through an opaque tunnel. So there was a psychological component to consider as well.
And did that keep people from wanting to ride the subway?
There was a fear it would, but then when you looked at the number of people who began riding the London Underground as soon as it opened in 1863, millions of people were riding it, and apparently it was a fear that could be overcome if you could get from point A to point B in 10 minutes or less.
Matthew Algeo is the author of New York's Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit. He's also the local host of Morning Edition here at Kansas Public Radio. At the same time that Alfred Beach was developing this underground system, engineers were creating elevated rail systems as well. A lot of us are familiar with the L in Chicago. How did the two of those compete against each other in this world of engineering?
There were many competing ideas for public transportation at the time. Alfred Beach's was only one of them. There were ideas for on-ground, at-grade railroads, above-ground railroads, underground railroads. The advantage Alfred Beach had was you couldn't really build an elevated railroad in secret. You really did need to get permission to do that. And so that gave him a little bit of a head start. It's also interesting, the Brooklyn Bridge was being built at the same time. Again, hard to build a bridge in secret. The overground railroads and the elevated railroads both ended up winning out in a way. I don't want to give too much away, but I think most people know there's not a large system of pneumatic subways in New York right now. The elevated railroad had the advantage, of course, it was so much cheaper, you didn't have to excavate. The problem was the technology was very poor at the beginning for locomotion. There was a system of cables. They had a cable-driven elevated train was built. You also had to overcome psychological obstacles for elevated railroads as well. Suddenly you look out the window and you're 15 feet above the ground. And, of course, people who lived on the second floor didn't like elevated railroads at all. So elevated railroads, one of my favorite was the Arcade. On Broadway, they would just dig out Broadway 20 feet, build a new Broadway down there, build another Broadway on top of it, have all the horses and streetcars go on the lower level and all the pedestrians on the upper level. There was the moving sidewalk. It moved 10 miles an hour that would just, you know, continuously be moving up and down Broadway. And then there was the elevated train, and I have a picture in the book of the first demonstration line, the first demonstration of the Greenwich Street L, and it's absolutely terrifying. I would much rather be 20 feet underground than up there riding that contraption. But as it proved, the L was a little easier to build.
The entrance to the tunnel that he was building was in the basement of a department store.
Right.
Why there?
I think there were two reasons. One, he got a good deal on the renting the sub basement from the Devlin brothers, and they owned the clothing store in the building. He also wanted to be right in the middle of things. This was on the corner of Broadway and Warren in Lower Manhattan, right across from City Hall. I mean, he built this, you could almost say, literally under the nose of Boss Tweed. And so he wanted to have it be right in the middle of things. He wanted to be able to do it, obviously, discreetly. Apparently, the Devlin brothers didn't care much what he did in the basement as long as he paid the rent. The basement was big enough that he could build this fancy waiting room that I talked about with the chandeliers and the fountains and everything. So it was really a matter, I think, of money and location, as with everything in real estate, right?
Let's jump to February 26th. 1870. Public officials, the press, and special guests get their first peek at Beach's pneumatic subway system. Matthew, can I have you read, what did the press and those special guests experience that day?
The guests began arriving at 2 o'clock sharp, the men donning long dark coats and tall silk hats, the women in long flowing skirts and striking shades of red, green, and blue, wrapped in jackets of velvet or brocade. The women wore hats, too, extravagant wide-brimmed affairs trimmed with flowers and ribbons. Martin Kalbfleisch, the mayor of Brooklyn, an independent city at the time, was there, as were Common Pleas Court Judge Charles P. Daly and a host of other luminaries. Entering through a door on Broadway, the guests descended a few steps into the space beneath Devlin's, and passing through another door, this one airtight, they entered what one visitor called a kind of Aladdin's cave, a long wide room with colorful pictures of rail carriages hanging on the walls, walls of polished oak and black walnut. Natural light streamed through circular glass blocks installed in the sidewalk above. Zirconia lamps, the kind used as limelights, added more illumination. Electric lighting was still a decade in the future. In the middle of the room was a water fountain stocked with goldfish, and in one corner sat a piano. Scattered about were plush settees. There was even a special area reserved for ladies. Such as expected to find a dismal, cavernous retreat under Broadway opened their eyes at the elegant reception room, the Times reported. The guests were greeted by a slight, dapper man with a painter's brush mustache. Alfred Ely Beach was the publisher of Scientific American magazine, a tireless promoter of American inventors, and an inventor himself. he had organized the soiree. This room, Beach announced, was the waiting room. But what was meant to be waited for? The answer to that question was a few more steps down, where astride a small platform, something so startling, so unexpected, that some of them must have gasped in amazement. A sleek, cylindrical passenger rail car that sat on tracks at the entrance of a brightly lit tunnel. It was an underground railway, a subway, America's first. But no engine was attached to the car. Beach explained to his bemused guest that this rail car was not powered by a lumbering, rumbling, soot-spewing locomotive, but by a blower, a huge stationary fan powered by a steam engine that would blow the carriage into the tunnel and suck it back out. Stepping inside the car, the visitors found it richly appointed with 22 upholstered seats. Like the waiting room, the interior of the car and the tunnel were lighted with zirconia lamps. Flanking the entrance to the tunnel were bronze statues of Mercury, the Roman god of travelers and commerce. Encircling the portal were gas lights covered with alternating globes of red, white, and blue. Alfred Beach had built a pneumatic subway, covertly, in the shadow of City Hall.
That's KPR's own Matthew Algio reading from his latest book, New York's Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit. Just days later, the public was invited to ride. What was the reaction?
The reaction was overwhelmingly positive. Beach charged 25 cents to ride this subway to essentially nowhere, down the street and back. It was kind of like a carnival ride. He donated the proceeds to an orphanage, by the way. He was pretty clever about public relations. People were amazed by it for several reasons. One, it was quiet. The fan would so gently blow the car down the tunnel and bring it back that people didn't even realize it was moving at first. This, of course, was in direct contrast to the cacophony that was Broadway at the time. Again, you can't imagine how loud Broadway was, all the horseshoes on the cobblestones and the vendors screaming and the drivers screaming at each other. This was quiet. It was also clean. There were no smoke or cinders. There was no horse poop. And it was comfortable. It was warm in the winter and it was cool in the summer. So there was an overwhelming demand for Beach to be awarded a charter to extend this line. Beach dreamed of extending it all the way up the island and all the way down to the Battery, collected thousands of signatures on petitions that were forwarded to the legislature, beseeching them really to give him permission to continue building this.
Matthew, I think it's fair to say that most of our listeners have never heard about New York's secret subway and this strange chapter in mass transit history. How did you become aware of it?
Well, Kay, it all goes back to progressive rock. Actually, I was listening to a Spotify playlist during the pandemic. There was a song by a Canadian band called Klaatu. Klaatu is named after the extraterrestrial character in The Day the Earth Stood Still. And they wrote a song called Sub Rosa Subway that tells the story of Alfred Beach. Now, it's not perfectly historically accurate, but it's close enough. And it begins back in 1870. So I heard this song, and I couldn't believe the story was true, and it sent me down the rabbit hole that 5 years later, here I am having written a book about it. I actually wrote the guy who wrote the song, who sent me a very nice letter back, because I was curious, why, what prompted you? And he said they were just paging through an encyclopedia, and they happened upon the entry for Alfred Beach and decided they would write a song. So I am grateful to Klaatu for preserving the memory of Alfred Beach and then making it possible for me to find this story. It's one of those stories where the first thing you do, you go look and say, there has to have been a book written about this. There has to have. So I was pretty surprised there wasn't. New York has had such a long and fascinating history that, you know, when you do a comprehensive history of New York, the secret subway might make a paragraph. So I was lucky.
So now there is a book.
Yes.
We're a long ways away from New York City and this story in both distance and time. How does the story of Alfred Beach and the secret subway speak to us today?
I think it's an American story, first and foremost. It's a story about American invention and the history of American invention. And I would also point out, Alfred envisioned a country crisscrossed by pneumatic tube transportation. He saw pneumatic tubes shooting across the country, over the mountains, through the mountains, over the rivers, under the rivers. I mean, Alfred envisioned pneumatic tubes through Kansas. I think he really saw it as the future of transportation. So I think it's also a lesson on futurism and the folly of it sometimes. But I think it's just a really cool story. It's an amazing story about somebody who overcame a lot of obstacles to achieve something great. And in the end, really, though it didn't succeed as he wished it had, it proved the concept was successful. So it's a really kind of an American success story.
You've written numerous other books. My favorite being Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, about the road trip that Harry and Bess Truman took after his presidency. What do these books have in common?
I like small stories. I like small stories that illuminate bigger issues. Like I said, in the grand scheme of things, in the history of New York, this little subway line that Alfred Beach built doesn't amount to much. But if you use it to tell other stories, I think it can really help you understand the time and the place where it occurred. I think stories like this are important to tell because if they get forgotten, an important piece of history will be lost. And I really like to try to save stories like that that might otherwise just disappear. I don't like the big stories as much as the little stories, I guess. I think they all have that in common. Plus, nobody else had written a book about them yet. That's important, too.
And now they have.
Yes.
Matthew Algio is the author of New York's Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit, and several other books. He's also the local host of Morning Edition at Kansas Public Radio. The Raven Bookstore in downtown Lawrence is hosting a launch party for New York's Secret Subway on Tuesday, September 30th. You can find out more at ravenbookstore.com and at malgio.net. Matthew, thank you so much for coming in and talking about New York's Secret Subway today.
Kay, you're welcome. It was a very short trip.
I'm Kay McIntyre. We'll have more KPR Presents coming up right after this.
Back in 1870, just beneath the Great White Way, Alfred Beach worked secretly, risking all to write a dream.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. Tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Once again this year, KPR's Live Day broadcast presents our own Destiny and Mermaiden. It's a free concert at the Lawrence Public Library, Friday night, October 24th. Admission's free, but seating is limited, so please RSVP now at kansaspublicradio.org. Then join us for a night of spooky tunes, tales, and bad jokes for Halloween, Friday night, October 24th at 7 o'clock, presented by Kansas Public Radio. Live Day, KPR Presents, and everything we do here on Kansas Public Radio is possible because you make it so. Give now at kansaspublicradio.org. And thanks.
Nothing could have prepared me for being diagnosed with a rare and deadly eye cancer in the middle of trying to save the Kansas land where my husband and I live.
Today on KPR Presents, Karen Miriam Goldberg from her latest book, The Magic Eye, a story of saving a life and a place in the age of anxiety. I'm Kay McIntyre. Karen Miriam Goldberg is a former poet laureate of Kansas, author of more than 24 books of poetry and prose, and a frequent guest on KPR Presents. It is always good to see you, Karen.
It's wonderful to be back here, Kay.
We'll talk about the saving a place part of the title in a bit, but let's start with the saving a life. Tell me about your experience being diagnosed with a very rare form of eye cancer.
Well, I had no idea that it was even a thing. I was having lunch with a friend, and she said, "What's up with your eye? It keeps twitching." And that led me to contact my doctor, and that led me to an ophthalmologist who got more and more serious and quiet as our visit went on. And he found I had a tumor in my right eye. And within a day, I got to see an ocular oncologist, Dr. Desai at St. Luke's, and I was suddenly on the big treatment for rare cancer treadmill. It seems like it's a protocol that was designed by extraterrestrials because it's so bizarre. This type of cancer I had was treated with a small gold disc with radioactive pellets sewn into the edges of it that's then surgically implanted behind my eyeball for 5 days. So it's a very big surgery to put it in, then I'm radioactive for 5 days, and then a big surgery to take it out. But, of course, that's just how it looks on the surface. It was a fairly painful procedure to go through, and I could barely face any light for months, and there were follow-up surgeries, and, you know, it was a much longer recovery than I would have anticipated, but I also didn't know what to anticipate. This is the type of cancer where everyone, you know, my doctor, my oncologist, my friends, my therapist said, do not research this on the web.
So, of course, you did.
I did at some point. Later on, and I, you know, almost went into a full panic attack. I really felt a sense of terror because it can be incredibly deadly. And so far, it's over 6 years out. I'm here. I'm doing really well. I'm monitored closely. And the main thing I'm monitored for are micrometastases to lungs or liver.
Karen, this is not your first experience with cancer, which you've written about extensively, but you said that cancer didn't prepare you for this cancer.
It really didn't. And when it comes to health emergencies, we might have this idea in our minds that we go through something and then next time it'll be easier. But I have since learned it's quite the opposite. And there is a thing called health PTSD, where you have one cancer, then you find out you have another, and it might feel even more overwhelming. But my first cancer was breast cancer. My mother and aunt had each had breast cancer twice. I knew that it was likely in my future. It just came earlier. I was 42 when I was diagnosed than I expected. And that was the type of situation where I could research constantly. My husband could research extensively. I could spend hours with my oncologist asking many, many questions. And there was a clear path ahead and a fairly good prognosis, although it was well over a year of surgeries and very aggressive chemo and more surgeries and so on to go through.
And I assume you probably knew people that had had breast cancer, whereas with your eye cancer, you didn't know anyone that had had anything like this.
But I started hearing some stories, and I recently have a friend who lives elsewhere in Kansas who came down with it, and he ended up working with my same oncologist, and we spent a lot of time texting and emailing and talking, and it was kind of shocking to him and shocking to me too. But breast cancer is so much more common. And of course, as a writer, whatever you give me, I'm going to write about it.
Why did you want to share this story, this very painful story?
Well, parts of it are painful. I hope parts of it are pretty funny too. Because there is a lot of humor when you get down to this kind of tender edge of life at times. I write about what I live, and I always have. My poetry and my memoir and fiction sometimes is fictionalized things I've lived or observed. So that's what I do, and that's what I have to do. There's an old Yiddish saying that everything can be survived if it's part of a story. And putting together a book like this gives me a narrative frame. It gives me a way to understand the scope and depth of it a little bit more and helps me to put myself back together in a new way.
I love that expression.
Yeah, whatever we're going through. And Kelly Hunt and I wrote a song called Miracle, and the chorus has, you know, about a round rainbow is called a glory. What you survive is like in life is part of, you know, is called a story. But you can't see the whole story until you get all the way around.
Karen Miriam Goldberg is the author of The Magic Eye, a story of saving a life and place in the age of anxiety. That title, The Magic Eye, do you think of your eye as magic?
At times I do. A friend suggested that. She said, now you're growing a magic eye, because I'm legally blind in my right eye, but if I look out of it, it's kind of like Matisse and Pablo Picasso and Gertrude Stein and I think Meredith Monk, all these kind of experimental and edgy artists got together and created a new way of seeing. Things are blurred, and because the eye is permanently dilated a little bit, everything's brighter, and there's not really a frame saying this is that and this is this. So a lot of this book is about new ways of seeing, which might speak to anybody no matter what their story is. And for me, in this world at this time, that's a necessary practice, that my old ways of seeing the world no longer add up.
I love how you use the very physical experience of your vision as a metaphor for understanding life in a broader sense. And I want to share a quote from your book, Karen. Don't try to find answers so you can have the illusion of control. Just acknowledge this moment of fuzzy vision and clear seeing, chaos and balance, beauty and pain.
It's really interesting that, you know, we're always looking for some answer, some ground under our feet. I really love the writing of Buddhist nun Pema Chodron, who talks about how life is groundless. You will think you know what you're doing, and then boom. But humans, we always want ground under our feet. You know, every morning I look at the news headlines, and I actually restrict myself to only looking at the news in the first half of the day so that I can sleep at night. But then I also step outside, and this morning it had rained, we had huge thunderstorms, and of course it was just as hot and steamy as yesterday. But there was something else in the breeze, and there was that smell of rain, and the light was really beautiful on the wet grasses and the prairie looking west from our house. And I remind myself that this is also the news. This is the world right now happening in real time. Because we have 24-hour news cycles available to us, because we have so many devices flashing things at us all the time, and they're all so addictive that a lot of us are checking all the time, it's hard to remember that there's this whole world that we're part of, outside, around us, in our communities, little stories that are happening with people. And of course, our own bodies are their own worlds. And things are happening all the time.
Again, Karen Miriam Goldberg is the author of The Magic Eye, a story of saving a life and a place in the age of anxiety. There are a number of recurring characters in your story. Your husband, Ken, your children, your many, many friends, your doctors, and turtles.
Turtles. Well, we have befriended a wonderful professor at Washburn University named Benjamin Reed, research on ornate box turtles in northeast Kansas. And some years ago, I think it might have been back to 2018, he drove to our house after finding a new turtle that he was going to put a transmitter on to track. And I said, "What's the turtle's name?" And he said, "Oh, I don't give them names. I give them numbers." And I said, "Can I name them?" And he let me. So I have named hundreds of turtles. You know, of course, there's a Gandalf and a Yoda and all of that. But there's also Harrison Ford and Eli Wiesel and a Barack Obama and a Chewbacca and so on. And during the time that I was going through treatment, Ben, with our permission, brought some of his students over and brought turtles from different places to, you know, set up mazes for the turtles and do more turtle research. And so there were turtles up all, you know, there's that expression, turtles all the way down, and it was turtles all the way around. And that gave me a lot of hope, too.
Karen, I'd like you to read from your book, The Magic Eye. In the excerpt that we've picked out, you refer to a group called the Turning Point.
Turning Point is part of the University of Kansas Medical Center, and it used to be an independent nonprofit, and they provide amazing workshops and resources for people and families and communities going through serious physical illness. And I have had the great honor of facilitating writing workshops at Turning Point since about 2003.
So well before your experience with this cancer.
Yes, and right after my experience with breast cancer. And so there's nothing like doing Zoom writing groups with 20 people living with chronic illness to talk about how whatever we're going through reveals more of who we are rather than takes us away from it. So facilitating this all the way through helped me too. "Oh, for the relief of pain" is an animal chorus coming back around at every turn. "May we be free of suffering and the root of suffering" goes one of the primary Buddhist prayers. "So much pain begets ripples of greater pain, often without resolving the original pain or with replacing it with something even more vexing. But not all pain can be relieved. Some of the Turning Point writers live with sharp or dull pain from years of harsh chemotherapy or progressive neurological disease. Some of my friends, surviving without beloved partners or parents or children, carry the fullness of acute and searing emptiness with them daily. Some of the people who brush past me in the food co-op or bank are hurting in an alphabet of agony most people can't imagine. All we can do is say, we're hurting. All we can ask, sometimes just with our silence, please help, or please just sit here with me cursing this moment of sharp edges. All we can tell ourselves is maybe tomorrow will be better, even if we're still repeating this refrain tomorrow. All we can give are the words, I love you, to the world."
That's Karen Miriam Goldberg reading from The Magic Eye, a story of saving a life and a place in the age of anxiety. Spoiler, Karen, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I am monitored closely just to make sure that I continue to stay cancer-free, but I have excellent care between Lawrence Memorial Hospital and St. Luke's, and I'm doing well.
I'm glad to hear that. The drama that was your eye cancer was playing out amidst another drama, what you call the, quote, well-developed one-act play called The Farm.
Mm-hmm.
For our listeners who are familiar with the Wells Overlook Park south of Lawrence, tell me about your family's connection to the land and your fight to keep it intact.
Well, when I fell in love with Ken, who's Ken Lastman, I also fell in love with the land where his family lived, and some of them still lived at the time. And the Wells Overlook is surrounded by 130 acres, and that was owned by his mother and her four sisters. When I married Ken, I knew I was marrying the farm, too. And our longtime plan, you know, hatched way back in the mid-80s, that we would do all we could to save this land. And we spent over 35 years trying to find ways to encourage the family to preserve it, or perhaps sell just a part of it, but keep as much intact as possible. And after all that time, everything came to a head while I was still in recovery from eye cancer.
Without getting too far into the weeds, can you talk about the role that the Kansas Land Trust played?
Well, the first thing we had to do was find a way to buy the farm. And as I say in the book, buying the farm without buying the farm. You know, that old Kansas expression. I kept saying, buying the land, purchasing the farm. And that took some doing and amazing magic of financing and creative ways of keeping the whole piece of land intact. But we had been in touch with the Kansas Land Trust for years. We had a file many years before we even bought the farm. Well, before we bought the land that was the farm, that we call the farm. And we wanted to put this land in a conservation easement, which would keep it from being developed in perpetuity, aka forever. But it turned out to be the most complicated and complex easement that Kansas Land Trust ever did, because we sold two 20-acre plots or parcels to people who had already lived there and or loved this land and also wanted to see it preserved. And we needed to do that in order to have the finances to buy the land. And, of course, we had Wells Overlook right in the middle. So it ended up being a conservation easement with three sets of owners with a county park in the middle. And that took a long time and a great deal of patience and hard work from the wonderful Kansas Land Trust board and staff. And I'm indebted to Jerry Jost, former executive director of Kansas Land Trust, Caitlin Stanley, the current director, Patty Beatles, who's involved as very much as their staff person on this, and Julie Coleman, the president, and their whole board, because they went above and beyond. They understood that this wasn't just a geographical and biological important piece of land to preserve, but also a historical one. Ken's family had been there five generations, and there were a lot of little historical threads that ran through that land. So as of the summer of 2024, the land is now protected forever.
What does that mean exactly? It's protected from what?
It's protected from development. We could sell our portion. The people who own the other parcels could sell their portions, but whoever buys them can't put any industrial or commercial businesses there. There's very, very limited building, even for homes that can be done, as in extremely limited. And the land needs to be kept as an agricultural and ecological resource. It's also part of the corridor of migrating animals from Clinton Reservoir all the way east and through the wetlands and so on.
All of this drama, your eye surgery, the land, all of that is playing out amidst the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, I wouldn't say that the pandemic was a positive development for anything, except sometimes in really dire historical moments like the pandemic, there's openings and things can come through that don't normally come through. And I believe, even though I have no way to logically explain this, that the veil was a little thinner between what was possible. And we were able to move ahead on putting the funding together and jumping through all the hoops. The legal description for this land is pages long and very complicated. In December of 2020, we closed on purchasing the land.
How did those three dramas, your eye surgery, the land, the pandemic, how did those fit together in your mind? They chronologically overlap, but did they overlap emotionally and mentally?
I think so. I mean, that was definitely my experience. I felt like the cancer I went through was a personal pandemic. And we've always looked at the land as an extension of who we were, of who we are. You know, body, land, we are intricately connected. Of course, in the most visceral way they probably fit together was waking up at 4 a.m. and worrying about something that in the light of day seems more manageable. And so that's why I call it the age of anxiety, because there's a lot to be anxious about in this world. You know, my old joke, which could be true, is that one-third of all Americans have an anxiety disorder, one-third have depression, and one-third just aren't diagnosed yet. But there's so much going on in the world that can feed our despair and can feed our fear and sense that things are just completely falling apart. And what can we find to hold on to? Where can we find faith? Where can we find clarity and direction? To me, that was at the core of how do we see ourselves and the world? And how do we keep working on seeing with greater clarity while acknowledging what's difficult, what feels impossible, and also acknowledging that at the same moment, oh, lilac may be blooming, or, you know, you might see a indigo bunting fly by.
That's lovely. We need to open our eyes.
We do.
You write extensively in both poetry and prose. Is there a poetry version of this story?
I do have a poem called Saving the Farm. So there's that. But there's little snippets of it in other things I've written too. And I really work on each line over and over again to make it as poetic as possible. And by that I mean vibrant and clear and rhythmic, just like I would in a poem.
In the midst of your story, The Magic Eye, Kansas Public Radio got a shout-out, specifically KPR's All Things Considered host, Laura Lorson.
Yes, that was about the tornado, wasn't it? Yeah, that whole chapter about the big tornado that hit Lawrence.
How did that seem to fit into the whole story of what's happening in your world?
Well, you know, the radio is kind of the backdrop, and also it's right in the front when you have something like this. But that story was just the unexpected, crazy, violent, very destructive things that can happen at the drop of a hat. And I tell that story framed in the story of the Pendleton Farm because I was their last customer to buy peonies before the tornado hit, the day before the tornado hit. So that's a story of how we come together as a community. Of course, it's also a story of being in a marriage where you're not so much in agreement. And if readers read the book, they'll see that my husband and I had a very large fight because he would not go down to the basement. He was waiting to see it.
He's a Kansas boy.
We still don't agree on what happened there. But, you know, that's marriage. You're not always going to be in perfect alignment. But you find ways through and you survive. And the Pendleton Farm has rebuilt. And many who have experienced such loss and trauma in that tornado have also persevered.
I want to share another quote from your book, The Magic Eye. There are so many lines in the story that really resonated with me. And this is a very short one. Prepare to be unprepared.
Yeah, it's definitely an oxymoron, and maybe it doesn't even make sense. But before surgery, that's what I kept telling myself. And for me, that means prepare by being as present as you can, feeling whatever fear you have and trying to befriend it rather than run away from it. You know, there's all the make arrangements part of preparing, but also at the same time knowing, this was about going into surgery, that we don't know how it will be. One of the big things many people have reminded me of, and I've experienced over and over, is that what I'm most worried and scared about in this world hardly ever plays out like I think it will. That life has a lot of imagination and things will play out in completely different ways, and we can't be prepared. Just like preemptive grieving, we feel grief for people and projects and places that are not going to be part of our lives anymore. But it's not like that takes the place of the big grief that comes afterwards.
Karen, do you have another excerpt you'd like to share with us?
Well, my next to last chapter is called The Gates Are Never Closed, and that actually is the title of the third section of the book. And that comes from a wonderful woman named Carrie Kane, who was leading services at the Lawrence Jewish Community Congregation for Yom Kippur, where we pray to be sealed in the Book of Life. And she said, actually, the gates are never closed. You know, in Judaism, we use a lot of symbols with gates and books and so on. So this is a few paragraphs from there. The gates may never close for this pandemic or future ones, for those who died, for the trauma shaken and heartbroken, for the fissures and craggy breaks in this country and between close friends or family about vaccine or virus, and for everyone carrying grief and love for those they lost. The gates to all this and all the love that remains are wide open. We live in a world, a cosmos, and even individual bodies of infinite transformations. Regeneration is the key that can click open the locks of danger, illness, even death. I think of all my loved ones, long dead or recently departed, and how something remains. That night, and the next, and seasons later, I will continue to go out to the deck each night. I will stand in the dark, half shivering, half at home in the wind, and listen. Given the odds, who and what isn't a miracle of life? The world knows what I want. All my prayers for the same thing, health and long life, or at least health as long as life grants it. But even in times of illness, life is granting me this air, this motion of bare or laden branches, this view that keeps wheeling into time, half circles, different directions, and where do I land? Here, telling you there's a story to tell. Cancer, pandemic, climate change, breakage, healing, discovery, orange lilies exploding against the house, and so much more. The story lands me back home where I find ways through even in the dark, especially in the dark. It's all here. The gates are never closed.
That's Karen Miriam Goldberg reading from her latest book, The Magic Eye, A Story of Saving a Life and Place in the Age of Anxiety. Karen, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure, and thank you for upholding KPR and KPR Presents. We are so lucky to have you in this station in our community. Long may it live.
I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.
Support for KPR Presents comes from Mammoth, presenting singer-songwriter Noah Reed on Saturday, October 4th at Liberty Hall. Tickets available through Ticketmaster.com. NKU Theater, presenting Lauren Gunderson's Silent Sky, inspired by the true story of astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. One weekend only, October 3rd through 5th at Murphy Hall. Tickets at KUTheater.com. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org.
The U.S. is in the middle of an affordable housing crisis. Could a silver tsunami of aging Americans fix it when they sell their homes?
Older individuals are expected to either downsize or when they move on and pass the home on to their kids, potentially their kids would actually put them on the market for sale.
I'm Elsa Chang. That's on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 87 and fair. Wind is from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid 80s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. It's 87 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather. I'm Maria Lopez.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
That's Jack Berger at the Bongos with Mambo Burger, here to kick off another round of the Retro Cocktail Hour. This is on the album The End on Bongos from 1957, also featuring flutist Buddy Collette. Welcome to the Retro Cocktail Hour, where the music's just always shaken, not stirred. Darryl Brogdon here doing most of the shaking at the Underground Martini Bunker. In the hour ahead, we'll hear from the Peruvian caterwauler, Ima Sumac, plus Arthur Lyman on his album Taboo. And we'll go to Bora Bora with Les Baxter. Besides that, we've got the Brazilian impressions of pianist Dick Hyman. Joni Summers sings the Bossa Nova. And we have tunes by the Midday Mai Tai Project, Mondo Sangue, and the Bud Hunga Combo. Let's party like it's 1959 on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. Joey Reyes and his Mocambo Orchestra, the Oink Oink Mambo, composed by Billy May. Joey led a society band in L.A. for many years, appearing mainly at the Mocambo on the Sunset Strip. Today, the building's occupied by a hairstylist. Hey, thanks so much for being here at the Underground Martini Bunker, home of the Retro Cocktail Hour. Still to come, Arthur Lyman with the title tune from his classic album Taboo, plus something new by the Midday Mai Tai Project. Next up, Ima Sumac, from what I think is her best album, Mambo, done in 1954. This came out originally as a 10-inch album, but a year later, Capitol Records added several more tunes and reissued it as a 12-inch LP. Arranged and conducted by Billy May, who really had a feel for albums like this, here's Goomba Boomba on KPR.
Thank you. love it, love it, come on, come on. Rumba, rumba, the love for me, rumba, rumba. Rumba, 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 rumba. Rumba, rumba, love it, love it, rumba, rumba. Rumba, rumba, love it, love it, rumba. Negro de mi corazón, te quiero.
Retro Cocktail Hour, with music by the Bud Hunga Combo. That one's called Bangala. It's from 1970 in the album Bud Hunga and His Diplomatic Music. What do you think diplomatic music is? Is it music to manage international relations by, maybe? This came out originally in 1970 on a Belgian record label. Rumor has it Bud Hunga is really Belgian conductor Roland Thiessen. Before that, the Arthur Lyman Group with the title tune from Taboo, their debut album, in 1958. Arthur Lyman was the original vibraphonist in Martin Denny's band and appears on their first album, Exotica, the year before this one came out. After that first record, Arthur left the Denny band to form his own group. Also, the Lombardo Twins, brothers Mario and Richie, who seem to have done just a few records. We heard them on Arabian Drums, featuring the voice of Dee Richards. Well, you've got the Retro Cocktail Hour and me, Daryl Brogdon, with Les Baxter's music for a European sexploitation film called Bora Bora. That's in our next half hour. Next, the Midday Mai Tais Project, an Exotica supergroup that features players from the Tiki Delights, Mr. Moai and the Tiki Heads, and the Manicuras. Add Mark Riddle to the vibes, and you got a band. Here's Nights in Bora Bora on KPR.
music is always shaken, not stirred.
Down.
On the Retro Cocktail Hour.
Ba-da.
A production of Kansas Public Radio.
Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from the University of Kansas, working to address major challenges in disease prevention and treatment, sustainable energy solutions, and more. Information about KU research at ku.edu. Did you know listeners are more apt to frequent businesses that support their local public radio station? Well, if you run a business, you can harness that passion for public radio by becoming a KPR sponsor. Learn more at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org. There's Les Baxter with Emerald Sea, music from a European sexploitation film called Bora Bora. Apparently it's all about a wife who runs away to the South Pacific and her husband who chases after her. It's the Retro Cocktail Hour, on the air from down below. And by down below, of course, I mean the underground martini bunker. Coming up, something new by pianist Antonio Adolfo with an album devoted to the music of Carnival in Rio. Also, we'll go under the sea with composer Sven Lebeck. The Retro Cocktail Hour is heard each and every week on stations like WPCA Amory, Wisconsin, KMUZ Salem, Oregon, and the stations of Wyoming Public Radio. To stream the show on demand anytime, it's Mixcloud.com or RetroCocktail.org. Dick Hyman at the piano with Sugarloaf, a tune from the album Brazilian Impressions, and here for you on the Retro Cocktail Hour. This was 1967 on Command Records, and it features Dick at the keys with a rhythm section and woodwinds. Just ahead, we'll hear a bossa nova album by singer Joni Summers, who's joined by guitarist Laurindo Almeida. Also, The Sounds of the Deep by Sven LeBeck. Here's a brand new one now, an album called Carnival by pianist Antonio Adolfo. He grew up in Rio in a musical family and was working as a professional musician by the time he was a teenager. He did his first album in 1964. Carnival is a collection of tunes often heard at the Carnival in Rio. Give a listen to Oba, also known as Breath of the Jaguar, on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you. watching the world go by. Out of step, girls, out of step, guys, watching the world go by. Oh, how the days turn into years, watching the world go by. Where is that sweet, enchanted place where every sky was blue? Where is that smile that once warmed your face? Where is that love we once knew? Where are those nights with their sparkling stars? Where are those days in the sun? Where are those dreams that once we had, when life had just begun? What did we seek and never find? What did we want and why? Just hold me close now and never mind.
That's a tune by Percy Faith called Posh Party, and it's from the movie The Oscar, 1968. The film is lousy. It's about a ruthless actor who will do literally anything to win an Oscar. But it's one of the few film scores by Percy Faith. Also in that set, Sounds of the Deep. This was composed by Sven Lebeck. He was born in Norway, studied at Juilliard in the States, and settled in Australia, where he writes music for movies and TV. This tune was featured in a documentary series called Inner Space, done by the Jacques Cousteau of Australia, Ron and Valerie Taylor. And later it was heard in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. And we heard from Joni Summers, joined by guitarist Laurindo Almeida, on Watching the World Go By. This is on the album Softly, the Brazilian Sound, 1964. Early in her career, Joni was kind of pigeonholed by her record label as a singer of songs about teenage angst. This album and others were Joni's attempt to get away from that teenage image. Retro Cocktail Hour, Daryl Brogdon, thank you so much for being here. Remember, you can listen to the show 24/7. If you're like me and truly have no life whatsoever, you'll find Retro Cocktail Radio, our streaming channel that plays continuous episodes of this here show, on the web. The link to stream all this grooviness is at retrococktail.org. That's also where you'll find playlists from past shows. You can join our mailing list, and every week I'll send you a detailed playlist for the current show. And there's lots more, too. It's at retrococktail.org.
Toccami inesauribile, passeggia le colonne, la gioia ti aspetterà. Baciami tra le mie labbra, dedica il tuo cuore all'eternità. Facciamo l'amore nello spazio eterno, senza
That's Mondo Sangue with Sangue Verde on the Retro Cocktail Hour. This is a duo comprised of Cristiano Sanguinero and Cristina Casariccia. They are passionate about the music of Italian B-movies, and each of their albums is devoted to a different genre. This one's from the album Vega 5, Adventures in the Cosmos. Daryl Brogdon here, Retro Cocktail Hour. Thank you for being here. If you need to reach out, my email's host@retrococktail.org. From the University of Kansas, KPR's KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute. There's more to come. If keeping your old car running is starting to feel like you're setting money on fire, the KPR Vehicle Donation Program can help extinguish that flame. Donate your vehicle online at kansaspublicradio.org to help support KPR.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
The Frankie Cap Percussion Group and Mexican Hat Dance, beginning this round of the Retro Cocktail Hour. Welcome to the show where no music is served that's not 100% shaken, not stirred. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Our location, of course, is the Underground Martini Bunker, party central for lovers of space-age pop and incredibly strange music. Up ahead in this hour, exotic themes for the silver screen by Michael Giacchino, something brand new by the Spanish band L'Exotigost, and Phil Moore's fabulous album Polynesian Paradise, done for a budget label and probably sold for $1.98 at your neighborhood supermarket. We'll also hear Lalo Schifrin's original Mission Impossible theme, the exotic percussion of Martin Denny and singer Lena Maria Cardinale with the Voodoo Five. Please return your tray tables to their upright and locked position. It's time for takeoff with the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. From an album called Mucho Calor, 1958, we heard Autumn Leaves. This is an album of Latin jazz by trumpeter Conti Candoli and alto saxophonist Art Pepper. They're joined here by Jack Costanzo at the congas and Mike Pacheco on the bongos. Thanks so much for digging the tunes here at the Underground Martini Bunker, home of the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon with Edmundo Ross, leader of one of the most successful and longest-running dance bands in the UK. Next, it's a band called The Executives. Now, as far as I know, they only made one record, a not uncommon feat among the bands we hear on this show. Their only record comes from the Edsel label, an obscure label in Hollywood with an unfortunate name. It seems to have recorded a lot of artists you never heard of, including people like the Prehistorics and a trombone player called Streamline Ewing. Here are the executives with the Moon Glow Cha-Cha-Cha on KPR.
with our windswept hair, we dance without a care. To live is to sing marijuana, cha cha cha. Cha cha cha.
That's Edmundo Ross and his orchestra, Good Morning Starshine, here for you on the Retro Cocktail Hour. This guy led a dance band in the UK that started in 1940 and kept going till 1975. His name became very well known in the 1940s when then Princess Elizabeth danced to his music at the Bagatelle restaurant in London. Before that, the Marijuana Cha-Cha-Cha, done by Linda Carone. It's on Linda's album, Lemon Twist. Find Linda on the web at lindacarone, that's carone.com. I'm Daryl Brogdon. This is the Retro Cocktail Hour, coming to you as always from right here at the Underground Martini Bunker. And coming up, Piero Piccioni, who wrote music for something like 300 movies during his career with a tune from the Italian comedy Three Nights of Love. The Retro Cocktail Hour is right here every week on some fabulous public radio stations, including KLCC, Eugene, Oregon, KCCU, Lawton, Oklahoma, and WSKG, Binghamton, New York. You can stream the show on demand any old time at Mixcloud.com and at RetroCocktail.org. Michael Giacchino, with music from the movie Monte Carlo, and on an album called Exotic Themes for the Silver Screen. This is an album of TV, movie, and video game themes, all composed by Michael Giacchino and all done Exotica style. The album says Volume 1, so I guess there's more to come. Still to come on the Retro Cocktail Hour, composer, musician, sound designer Jim Fegan, who's done several albums of Exotica music. It's in the next half hour. Right now, though, Piero Piccioni, composer of hundreds of scores for European movies. He also led a very successful jazz band at one time in Italy. This guy did all kinds of movies, spaghetti westerns, sci-fi, thrillers, sex comedies, you name it. From 1964, it's a movie entitled Three Nights of Love. This was a comedy about various women who just want to find love. Here's Sally Surf on KPR. We'll be right back.
This is the Retro Cocktail Hour.
I was going to make espresso.
A production of Kansas Public Radio.
Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from KU Theater, presenting Lauren Gunderson's Silent Sky. Inspired by the true story of astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. One weekend only, October 3rd through 5th at Murphy Hall. Tickets at kutheater.com. Well, that is a new one by L'Exotic Ghost, that fine Spanish band that brings a modern take to the sound of exotica music. They have a new album coming out. It's called Hawaii Is On Your Mind. And from that, we heard the title tune. Also in that set, Phil Moore and his orchestra, Fiji Farewell, a tune from Polynesian Paradise, done for one of the most notorious of the budget labels, Strand Records. Their albums use the cheapest vinyl and what would be considered bargain bin filler, meaning records that are mostly by people you never heard of, sold for $1.98 at the supermarket checkout. But once in a while, they manage to accidentally hit gold, which is what happened with Fillmore's Polynesian Paradise. And before that, Eyes of the Idol, done by Jim Fegan. Jim is a sound designer slash composer slash musician. He's done a bunch of albums lately, many with an exotica vibe. This is the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon with Lalo Schifrin's original Mission Impossible theme coming up. Now here's Martin Denny from an album called Exotic Percussion. This is Mizzer Lou on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. No need to tell you what that is, right? It's Lalo Schifrin and probably one of the top five TV themes ever written. The Mission Impossible theme. It's got an unusual time signature, 5-4. Schifrin once said that music is often in 2-4 or 4-4 because people only have two legs to dance to it. So the MI theme, according to Schifrin, is for people from outer space who have five legs. Well, however many legs you have, I hope you stick around, because coming up on the Retro Cocktail Hour, another Italian composer, Marcello Giambini, from an album of themes he wrote for Mondo movies, those wild pseudo-documentaries that tackled taboo subjects and that were so popular in the 1960s. Hey, what do you wear when you listen to the Retro Cocktail Hour? You'll find that listening while you wear a Retro Cocktail Hour t-shirt just increases your enjoyment. Laboratory tests almost prove it. And you can grab one of our t-shirts or a sweatshirt emblazoned with the logo in our online store. Just visit retrococktail.org. On the Retro Cocktail Hour, that's Lena Maria Cardinale, accompanied by the Voodoo Five, with the theme song from You Only Live Twice. You can find this one at Bandcamp.com. Before the hour's up, we're going to hear something by composer Kiara Geller from an album called Stereo Demonstration. Maybe a test for your woofers and tweeters or whatever, and it's coming up in just a matter of minutes. Right now, though, it's Marcello Giambini, another Italian composer who worked on tons of European films during his career. Among the titles of films for which Marcello wrote the music are things like For a Few Dollars Less, War of the Planets, and Erotic Nights of the Living Dead. That last one's all about a bunch of people who sail to a mysterious island to have sex and then get killed off one by one. We're not exactly talking Ibsen here, folks. From the album Mondorama, which features tunes by Marcello Giambini from Mondo Movies, those phony exploitation documentaries that were so popular in the 60s, this is Tiber Rock on KPR's Retro Cocktail Hour.
Thank you.
Here's a tune from the Chapel Library by Lee Mason. It's called Girls About Town. It's from around 1973. Well, it do appear we're nearly out of time for this round of the Retro Cocktail Hour, which means we are out of here. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join us next time at the Underground Martini Bunker and listen on demand anytime at Mixcloud.com or RetroCocktail.org. Here's one now by composer Kiara Geller. This is a tune from Stereo Demonstration. It's called Tom 2 on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, KPRs KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from the Winter School, a recently renovated one-room schoolhouse in Lecompton, open to the public for music, art, history, and prairie tours during the Kaw Valley Farm Tour on October 4th and 5th. Details at winterschool70.com.
I'm Leila Faldel. A bit behind on the news. No sweat. We got you.
Okay, so just remind us, who is suing the government here?
What do you know about this executive action?
So how are conservatives who oppose Trump feeling right now?
What jobs are being cut out there?
If the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau cannot do its work, what does that mean for Americans?
No matter what the headlines bring, we'll break it all down for you. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Lopez. Now here's your weather forecast.